Saturday, December 25th, 4:45 p.m., Tonopah, Arizona. Michaels rode in the second helicopter of his trip, heading for the hijacking site on Interstate 10, about 40 miles west of Phoenix. John Howard had flown out in one of NetForce's chartered 747s with his strike team and had set up a command post at a truck stop just outside Tonopah, Arizona. The ground was a beehive of activity. Cars, trucks, troops, flashing lights. Michaels exited the craft and walked to where Howard stood.
How's it going?
This way, sir.
A chilly wind blew across the dry land, but inside the mobile tactical unit, a fiberglass-framed tent the size of a small house, the air was warm. A dozen techs worked on various electronics, mostly computers and comm gear. Howard stopped in front of a big flat screen on a stand.
Somebody sent the routing information for 4 shipments of plutonium scheduled to move today to a paramilitary group that calls itself the Sons of Patrick Henry. Here are the sites.
Red dots pulsed on the map. France, Germany, Florida, and Arizona.
All 4 went off simultaneously. We got word to the convoys ASAP. The Florida and German convoys took alternate routes and encountered no problems. We alerted the French authorities. They got there in time to stop the assault. We called the Army Transport Group here too late. By the time the National Guard and state boys and girls showed up, it was all over. They left behind a couple of anti-tank mines to slow pursuit. The State Patrol lost 2 cruisers and 3 officers. 5 civilian cars also got blasted.
Where do we stand?
We know who did it. We know where they are. It's just north of Gila Bend Indian Reservation, not that far from here. These people apparently own property all over the country, and they've got branches all over the world. We got the place footprinted with 1 K-1 Albatross spy sat.
This is where you think they took the plutonium?
GPS puts it in the southwest corner of this building, right there.
Where's the army?
They're massing their teams 30 miles south of the bolt hole, on the old Luke Air Force target range.
What are our options, the tactical considerations, if we get the nod?
Howard flashed a tiny grin, teeth bright against his chocolate skin.
Fast and dirty. We can give the Air Force a call. They can drop a big smart rock that'll squash the Suns flat before they ever know it's coming. End of immediate problem. Course, that could spread the plutonium dust all over the surrounding countryside, which might upset the locals.
You don't see any possibility of negotiation here?
No, sir. We're talking everything from treason to multiple murder to a dozen other local, state, and federal felonies. Their manifesto is, give me liberty or give me death. And we can't dick around long enough to let them think about things they might do with that heavy metal they borrowed.
You don't think they've booby-trapped the container?
No, sir, I don't. They haven't had time to think about it much. I see an infantry-style assault in the dark as our best bet. Since these guys are gun nuts, they've probably got spook eyes and motion detectors, but we can get close enough to knock those out and be on top of them before they have time to figure out what's happening.
What if they have heavier weapons? Rockets, AP, like that?
We got 6 jump troops who can use parasails well enough to hit a spot the size of a dinner plate from 6,000 feet at night. I've got green hats, black hats, SEALs, the best of the best on this team. Those camo clowns won't know what hit 'em, no matter what they're shooting.
You want this one, Colonel?
Again, the smile. Larger this time. Yes, sir. You bet.
I'll call the director and see what the situation is.
Howard watched as Michaels moved off to a quieter part of the tent to use his Virgil. Did he want this operation? Shit. He couldn't imagine anything he could want more just at the moment.
Sir, we got the second bird coming online, about to step on the location, Fernandez said.
Put it on the holoprod so we can get a 3D view.
As the colonel orders.
A 2-story ranch house sat in the middle of the compound, which was surrounded by a chain-link fence, probably 10 feet high. There was also what looked like a wooden barn and a smaller storage building behind the house. 4 trucks, 2 cars, and a single-engine high-wing airplane were parked in front of the main house. There were 2 guards on the gate with rifles or carbines slung over their shoulders and holstered sidearms. A 3rd guard with a large dog patrolled the fence in the back.
We have any idea how many are in there, Julio?
Fernandez drifted over and shook his head.
No, sir. Most we've seen it at times half a dozen, 4 men and 2 women. No children, thank God.
Michaels came back, clipping the Virgil onto his belt, next to his taser. Howard raised his eyebrows.
It's ours, Colonel.
Howard grinned, real big.
Colonel, Merry Christmas. I hope it doesn't blow up in our faces.
Saturday, December 25th, 9 p.m., Bladensburg, Maryland. Hughes had just walked into the safe house apartment when his Virgil buzzed. He looked at the ID. Senator White.
Hello, Bob. Merry Christmas. Tom, what's all this I've been hearing about some kind of nuclear material getting stolen?
My sources tell me the leak came from Net Force headquarters.
I'll have Michael's head on a platter if that's true.
It'll keep until after the holidays, Bob.
All right, if you say so.
Platt swaggered in.
Give my love to June and the girls.
I will. Merry Christmas, Tom.
Platt walked to the refrigerator, opened it, and took out a plastic bottle of apple juice.
Seems like such a waste, telling the sons of whoever about all the shipments, then telling the feds on them.
Hughes shook his head. Platt was definitely a loose cannon. Sooner or later, he was going to shoot the wrong way, or blow himself and everything around him into bloody pieces.
What about the guys guarding the uranium? He don't feel like they're dead because of you?
I didn't pull any triggers. I didn't tell anybody else to, either. Our goal here is not to blow things up.
I hear you.
Good. I think it's time the subversive group responsible for all these problems on the net steps up to claim credit. Let's show them the manifesto.
Platt grinned.
I've been waiting to do this.
Don't embellish it, Platt. Just like I wrote it.
No prob, boss. It's bad enough without me fiddling with it.
A loose cannon with a short fuse. If Hughes didn't deactivate him soon, Platt was going to screw the whole thing up. A couple more weeks, a month, they'd be over the hump, and Platt was going to have a fatal accident. Maybe just disappear. Saturday, December 25th, 9:35 p.m., in the air over southern New Jersey. Tony sat on the left side of the commuter jet, staring into the dark over the ocean in the distance. Jay Gridley's call had come as a surprise, but it wasn't such a great loss that she had to leave the annual gathering a little early. She loved her family, but after a couple of days cooped up in the apartments with them, things could get a little contentious. It surprised her, too, that Alex had cut short his visit home to fly from Boise to Arizona. He wasn't a field operative, and she worried about him. John Howard wouldn't let Alex do anything dangerous, she hoped, but it still gave her butterflies, thinking about Alex being on site for a hot op. He should be back at HQ, and the strike team should be doing its job without him. She leaned back in the seat and stared through the window. The jet was half empty. Not a lot of people traveling on Christmas Day. Saturday, December 25th, 11:15 p.m., Sugarloaf Mountain, Boulder, Colorado. Sitting in the propane-heated spa set into the redwood deck behind the cabin, Joanna and Maudie watched the snow fall into the hot water and melt. Winthrop took another sip from the second bottle of champagne they'd bought, splurging their own money for the good vintage after they'd polished off Maudie's admirer's gift. Maudie raised her glass and watched a few snowflakes hit the wine. She said, "Problem with this is that you get spoiled real quick. After the expensive stuff, the cheap champagne tastes like something you'd clean your oven with." From inside the cabin, a calm chirped, a 1-2-3 rhythm.
"That's mine," Winthrop said.
"Damn, don't answer it."
She considered it for a moment.
"Nah, I better. Could be my family."
Winthrop stepped out of the water and padded through the snow to where a pair of thick beach towels hung on a rack next to the doors.
"Damn, girl, if I was into women, you'd be my first choice,"
Maudie said.
"You got a great butt. Speaking strictly as somebody who knows how much work it takes to get one to look like that, of course."
Winthrop grinned.
"Beauty is only skin deep. Yeah, but a great butt is a joy forever."
The caller ID showed the name Lonesome J. Gridley. She listened as he filled her in on the situation with the terrorists' attacks on nuclear transport.
"I'll catch the next plane I can back to HQ."
"That isn't necessary. I believe we can get along without you for a couple more days."
"What aren't you telling me, Gridley?"
"That leak I mentioned that seemed to come from inside Net Force?"
Yes?
It came from your station. Talk to you later.
He discommed. Winthrop stared at her calm as if it were a rat come to life in her hand.
Oh, man, this sucked.
Sunday, December 26th, 1:50 a.m., Gila Bend, Arizona. Howard looked around. His strike team troops were loaded in three transport vehicles, and they were parked in a dusty stretch of desert with a slightly overcast sky. Probably the stealth shells wouldn't even be necessary. So far, there hadn't been any radar signature emitted from the ranch, so maybe the terrorists hadn't had time to get a unit, or if they had, to set it up. Each of the vehicles held six troopers, suited, locked, and loaded. Except for the LOSER headsets, line-of-sight infrared tactical comms, the strike team would keep radio silence until after they had secured the objective. And since LOSER signals were encrypted, even if the terrorists had a full-range scanner, they wouldn't get anything but gibberish. Weapons of choice were H&K 9mm subguns and H&K tactical pistols. Howard himself carried a much more unofficial weapon, a 1928 Thompson 45 caliber submachine gun that had belonged to his grandfather. Normally, he'd be using a 30 caliber assault rifle, a 7.62, but like the S&W revolvers strapped to his right hip, the Tommy gun was a good luck piece, an old but still functional good luck piece. His antique revolver and Chicago typewriter notwithstanding, whoever these camo clowns were, they didn't have the state-of-the-art combat gear that Netforce had. Howard looked at his watch.
The transport plane will be entering the drop zone in 33 minutes. It's running whisper props, but even so, out here sound carries. We've had a series of spy sats providing continual footprints of the area, so we pretty much know where every terrorist is. We'll have continual coverage through the expected duration of the attack, and a little longer, too, just in case things don't go quite as planned. Alpha Team will hit the main building with flashbangs, while Beta Team covers the rear of the house, the barn, and the storage shed. Delta Team will patrol outside what's left of the fence.
Howard glanced at his watch again.
All right, people, this is it. Let's roll.
Good luck, Colonel. Give him hell.
Thank you, sir. We will.
Fernandez slid his helmet visor down and clicked his spook eyes on, then cranked the engine and moved out. Howard picked up his computerized helmet from the floor by his feet and slipped it on, put the visor down, and lit his own night vision scope. He buckled his three-point seatbelt into place, snapping the black steel latch shut with a hard clack.
"Will you look at that?" Fernandez said. "Bugs Bunny!"
A jackrabbit angled across their path, then cut sharply back and stopped as the Humvee rolled past. It sat there watching as the cruisers also zipped past, turning its head to track them. Alex Michaels walked back to the four-wheel drive they'd given him, a little Subaru Outback. The strike team was out of sight in the darkness, heading for a rendezvous with the bad guys 10 miles away. He should have stayed at the tent HQ, back at the Texaco truck stop in Tonopah, but even if he wasn't a frontline soldier, he had wanted to come at least this far. He started the car, headed back to the dirt road a mile or so away that would take him to the highway a couple miles past that. It was really dark out here, the only source of illumination his headlights, and he bounced along for what seemed a lot longer than a mile. He reached the dirt road. For just a moment, he wasn't sure about which way to turn. Alex paused, then made up his mind. There was no danger, he knew. Not to himself, nor to Colonel Howard's strike team. The terrorist camp was several miles away, at least 4 or 5, so he could head this way for a couple of miles. The road dipped into a gully, came up, and he rolled over several half-buried rocks in the dirt, jolting him hard enough so his head nearly hit the roof. He didn't remember that part of the drive coming in. None of it looked familiar. Dark as it was, he couldn't see anything but what was in the cone of his headlights, but surely he should have reached the highway by now. Michaels shook his head. Brother, wouldn't that be a story for the folks at HQ? You heard about how Commander Michaels got lost in the desert? A man stepped out of the scrub growth. He wore chocolate chip desert camouflage pants and a jacket, and held a short assault weapon in his hands, pointed at Michaels' car. He waved the weapon, his meaning clear, pull over. An AK-47? Fear spasmed in Michael's belly as he realized who this must be. It was one of the terrorists. Oh, shit. What had he done? Better still, what was he going to do now? 2:24 a.m., Gila Bend, Arizona. Howard looked at his watch.
Ready to rock, Sergeant?
Just call me Elvis.
The compound was just ahead, a smear of hard yellow flaring in the spook eye's optical field from the security light mounted high on the wall of the barn, which illumination should be going out just about. Now the compound went dark.
Better make sure your filters are up, Colonel. The light show is about to begin.
Time slowed for Alex Michaels as the gunman walked toward his car. In what couldn't have been more than a couple of seconds, Alex sorted through all the possibilities he could think of. He could try to talk his way out of it. He could stomp the gas pedal and haul ass. He could pull his taser. He could shit or go blind. The gunman got to within a foot or two of the door.
Choose, Alex. Choose!
Gate, dead ahead, Fernandez yelled. Looks like our sappers have taken it down along with the guards.
Alpha has landed, came a voice over Howard's loser. We're in the door.
Beta's got the back, came another voice. Delta's on patrol, came a third.
Fernandez slewed the Humvee to a stop by the shed where the chickens were kept. Howard bailed out, the Thompson held ready.
Damn!
Howard turned, saw a man and a woman in the doorway to the barn, illuminated by the bright yellow-orange of their muzzle flashes as they fired bursts from fully automatic rifles at him and Fernandez. A bullet hit Howard on the torso. It felt like being whacked with a hammer.
Shit.
Michaels yanked the latch up, threw his weight against the door, and slammed it into the surprised gunman. It wasn't enough to knock him down, but it did rock him off balance. But he quickly recovered enough to swing the assault rifle around. Michaels pulled the door shut, thrust the taser through the open window, and fired the weapon. The man jerked, juttered toward the car as the capacitor needles fed him however many thousand volts they held. The assault rifle nosed skyward and went off five or six times in one long noise, blat, flashing red-orange and making less noise than it seemed it should. Michaels exhaled his held breath. Howard looked at the man and woman who had opened up on him and Fernandez. They weren't using concealment or cover, just standing there, hosing. So Howard V-stepped hard to his left, brought the Thompson up to a quick kill point, and triggered a five-round burst at the man. Without waiting to see the effect, he shifted his index to the woman. Brap! The shooters collapsed, and the man beat the woman to the ground by maybe a half second.
We have the objective, Alpha's team leader said over the loser.
Howard blew out a big breath.
Copy, Alpha. Good work. Doc, Julio took one in the leg. Get over that PDQ.
30 seconds later, Delta Team's vehicle, empty except for the driver, Doc, plowed right through a section of fence, slapped it flat, and skidded to a stop 10 feet away. Doc flicked his helmet spotlight on and used a suit cutter to open a big flap in the leg of the wounded sergeant's armor.
Looks like a 20-caliber high-velocity hardball. Missed the bone, no expansion. I don't see any problem.
Howard nodded, relieved.
Let's hear it, people.
The reports came in.
A walk in the park, sir, Alpha's team leader said. Objective is patent, no leaks, BG radiation levels normal. Send Doc on in when he gets a minute.
Howard blew out a sigh. They had the stolen nuclear material, and Julio was going to be okay. It could have been a lot worse. Time to call Michaels.
Commander?
Colonel, everything okay?
Yes, sir. Objective achieved, terrorist neutralized. Sergeant Fernandez picked up a little scratch.
Outstanding, Colonel. Congratulations. Please pass it on to your team.
Thank you, sir. We'll see you at Field HQ as soon as we get things cleaned up here.
I'm on my way there now.
Sir, you aren't there yet?
I took a little ride in the country. I picked up a hitchhiker you might find interesting to talk to when you get back. I'll explain it when I see you.
Sir, discom.
After he signed off, Howard considered his relationship with Commander Alexander Michaels. He wasn't bad for a civilian. Not bad at all.
Can we hurry this up and go home, sir? Fernandez said. I have an early tango lesson I don't want to miss.
Howard laughed. Monday, December 27th, 1:30 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard thought he might just go Nova, might just shatter into a million billion pieces. He sat on Bella's bed, his arms around her, and they kissed. Her back felt hot under his hands, even through her shirt, and there wasn't a strap across her smooth skin. She broke the kiss
and let out a big sigh.
You have to leave now, Tyrone.
Uh-huh. He leaned in and kissed her again.
No, really, Tyrone, I have to go.
Uh-huh. Finally, she pulled away again and said,
I'll see you at the mall tomorrow. You duplicate?
She took his hand in both hers, kissed it on the palm, then pressed it against her left breast. His mouth fell open. His brain went into vapor lock. He stood, knowing what a zombie must feel like. Explode. He was going to just blow up and splatter all over the room. It would make a big, gooey mess. How could he not? He couldn't stand it. Monday, December 27th, 2 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Julio Fernandez was in what passed for the infirmary at HQ. He looked at the time sig on the TV screen. He'd come back from the raid and been examined at noon. So he was stuck here until noon tomorrow. Boredom and cafeteria food loomed and threatened. Jesus. A nurse came in, and with her was the colonel. He grinned real big.
How's the leg?
Fine. I could take you on the obstacle course right now.
I'd almost rather be doing that than going home.
Your mother-in-law still there?
Until next Sunday.
Serves you right, sir.
By the time she got back to HQ, Joanna Winthrop knew the party was over. The terrorists had been taken down, the stolen plutonium recovered, and the only thing she had to do now was figure out who had gotten into her workstation and used it to give the sons of whoever the information about the shipments. Somebody had told her that Julio Fernandez had been shot and was in the infirmary.
Sergeant Fernandez? Lieutenant Winthrop. I heard you got shot. A scratch. So how are you doing? I heard about the workstation business. Oh, don't worry about that. I'll figure it out. Any suspects? At the top of my list, Jay Gridley. He doesn't like me. He thinks I slept my way into this job. Seriously? That he thinks I used my feminine wiles, or that he planted the leak in my station? Yes to the former, no to the latter.
There was a moment of quiet where neither of them spoke.
So, how was it?
She asked.
The sortie. Oh, the bad guys weren't in our league. They were outsmarted, outmaneuvered, and outgunned. Too bad I missed it. You been on a few field ops? Nothing lately. The colonel thinks I'm more useful in front of a computer. He's right. Grunts like me are a dime a dozen, but a computer genius is harder to replace.
She smiled.
Anything I can do for you?
She saw him hesitate a second, wondered if there would be an off-color remark. If he was looking for an opening, this was a good one. He shook his head.
No, ma'am, but thank you for asking. See you when I get out.
He flashed her a nice smile. Jay Gridley had given up on the cowboy scenario because it felt too slow, so now he turned to one of his favorite action heroes, borrowing from one of the early classic James Bond movies, Thunderball. Over the landscape he flew, zipping through the air with the famous Bell rocket belt on his back. The original rocket belt was essentially nothing more than a pair of fuel tanks, some handlebars, a throttle, and a couple of rocket nozzles. Jay's version had a secret but theoretically possible fuel and a miniature jet engine that gave him an hour in the air and an automatic safety reserve to allow him to land when the fuel ran low. Right at the moment, Jay was zooming over the new 16-lane South China Causeway from just outside Zhangang, Hong Kong, heading north to Zhuilong on the mainland, looking for Wong Electronic Trucks. Wong Electronics made some minor pieces of hardware, but they specialized in transmission software, readers and mailers, and certain kinds of security programs. Whoever had snuck into Winthrop's computer had erected a couple of firewalls and dug two deadfalls on his or her way out to cover his or her ass, and from the size and shape, even without the snipped-off ID codes, Jay knew the walls and falls were top-of-the-line Wongware. There was one of the orange-roof trucks now, a couple hundred feet below and half a mile ahead. He throttled back on the belt's thrust and started to lose altitude. He achieved the rear of the truck, shucked off the jetpack, and got out his lockpicks. It took him 45 seconds to get the door open. From 1,000 feet above Jay Gridley, Platt watched, holding slow and level the helicopter he found himself flying in when he dialed into Gridley's scenario. He watched the Net Force operative settle toward the orange roof of the Wong Electronics truck on the freeway below.
This little gook in his jetpack didn't have a clue who he was dealing with. He was going to get his ass kicked, and Platt was going to love doing it, too. When he was over the truck, and maybe 60 feet up, he opened the copter's window and leaned out, a 25-pound barbell weight in one hand. The steel plate fell, hitting the cab. Nobody got hurt, but it ought to rattle little Jay pretty good.
We're having fun now, ain't we?
Friday, December 31st, 4 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. It was Jay Gridley who was the bearer of bad news.
I think you ought to take a look at this, boss.
Michaels looked at it. He started to read it aloud.
Overlord beasts of America, know you, beasts, that your days are numbered. Know you, oppressors of the disenfranchised people, that the number of the beast is 666. We, the freed sexa, will bring you low, you despoilers of earth.
Michaels looked up from the hard copy.
Freed sex?
It's Danish. It means axis of liberty.
Your wicked ways are manifest and myriad, and we shall reveal your sickness to all. Brother.
Michaels looked at Jay again. So why didn't you add this one to the pile of other wackaloos claiming responsibility for the leaks?
Next page,
Jay prompted. On the next page was a list of numbers.
Those are the original posting times and dates for all the major leaks we've been running down. We went back and found a posting of the master list for last month's new American Express customer names and numbers. And for all the computer-controlled railroad safety lights and switches on the main commuter line between Washington and Baltimore. A bright hacker could use those to pile half a dozen trains up into big heaps of smoking scrap before somebody figured out what was going on.
Michaels looked at the number. The last one in the sequence read 12-31-10, 11-59-59.
That's tonight, December 31st, 1 second before midnight.
Yes, sir. If these are the guys, they're going to leak something just as the new year arrives.
Any way to trace this?
Sure, we already did. Posted from a payphone in Grand Central Terminal.
Better tell your shift they won't be partying tonight.
Happy New Year, boss.
Yeah, right.
Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 12:03 a.m., Marietta, Georgia. Platt sat in the kitchen of his house, his laptop computer on the wooden table next to the fridge. He took another big old slug of Southern Comfort and Coke over ice and giggled. 4 minutes it had taken the NetForce pukes to snag his posting. Platt was on the wireless modem, had beamed a signal to a rebroadcaster, and then into a little throwaway StoopCom he'd set up in a rented room in San Diego, California. Probably they'd have a team of feds kicking in the room's door in an hour or two, but that was okay. It had given something to do. But finding the computer in San Diego wasn't going to do them no good, no good at all. They couldn't get anything off it that was going to point them at him. The info in the squirt wasn't much. A list of all the patients treated for sexually transmitted diseases reported to the Atlanta CDC MedNet for the last 6 months. It was something to rattle NetForce's cage, to show that the little manifesto Hughes had cooked up was legit. A throwaway, that was all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We having fun now, ain't we, boys?
Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 1 a.m., Washington, D.C. Hughes sat in bed, reading a recent biography of the Norwegian Vidkun Quisling. Quisling, a career army officer whose name later came to be synonymous with traitor, had in the late 1930s formed in his country a socialist party, the Nasjonal Samling. The biographer was convinced that Quisling's policies had cost Germany the war. Had he not tried so hard to Nazify the country, the writer was convinced there would not have developed much of a Norwegian resistance movement. The resistance movement was never more than a small thorn in the Nazis' side, but it did cause a fair amount of industrial sabotage. Hughes thought this Quisling cost the war theory was something of a stretch, but the writer nonetheless echoed a valid point from all the vaults of history. For want of a nail, a war could be lost. One man, in the right place, at the right time, could alter the course of the entire world.
Hughes had always been fond of the story about the French physician Joseph Ignace Guillotin, who helped pass a law requiring legal execution be performed by a machine that would not miss, to be more humane to the condemned, rich and poor alike. What a wonderful legacy for one's relatives. A family name with which to inspire gasps and revulsion. How lovely that must have been. But men like Quisling and Guillotin had been small of vision and not gifted with Hughes's intelligence. In a few days, he would be going to Guinea-Bissau to sit with the head of that small country's government, to strike a deal that would someday be viewed by history as one of the most daring and clever schemes of all time. If history was written by the victors, then surely he would write his own. He did not for a moment doubt it. Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 7 a.m., Washington, D.C. In her kitchen, waiting for the coffee maker to finish brewing, Tony held the sheathed Chris in both hands. Maybe it did have enough magic to help her with Alex. She had been sleeping with it in its wooden sheath on her nightstand, blade carefully pointed away from her head. She was willing to take any help she could get. Tony grinned as the coffee maker chose that instant to gurgle and belch the last of the coffee into the pot, a kind of brewed raspberry noise, almost as if making fun of her. Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 7 a.m., Oro, California. Joanna Winthrop stood in the warm spring sunshine, waiting for the train to arrive. She wore a long, yellow, patterned dress, a bonnet, and held a small, tube-shaped, brown leather travel satchel. The year was 1916. She was at the Oro Station in Northern California. She could use some help to find the hacker who had used her computer station. The guy had left a trail, but it was faint and rigged with booby traps all along the way. She was beginning to get really pissed off. When she found this guy and turned him over to the Phoebes, she was hoping to get at least one clean kick at his testicles before they hauled him away. Having your supposedly secure computer station used for sabotage was at the very least embarrassing. It was one thing to be thought beautiful when it got in your way. It was another thing entirely to be thought inept at what you did for a living. The incoming train's whistle blew twice, steam-powered hoots that echoed into the station. There were only a few passengers waiting in her scenario, none of them paying any attention to her. She liked this time. It allowed her to wear clothes that could utterly conceal her shape and most of her features. The locomotive arrived, pulling a passenger train of some 16 cars, blasting clouds of steam, its great wheels squealing and squeaking to a halt at the platform. Well, it didn't matter how many traps this Bodo left in his wake. She was going to track him down. Monday, January 3rd, 8:02 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex Michaels leaned back in his chair and wished he was somewhere else. Just about any place would do, instead of sitting here listening to one of Senator White's staffers drone on at him over the phone. "So I can pencil you in for the committee meeting?" Michaels thought about it for a second. What if he said no? That would be fun. They'd have to subpoena him. "I'd be happy to talk to the Senator's committee." So, at worst, he'd be on the hot seat for a day or two, assuming nobody else was slotted. After he hung up, Michaels leaned forward in his chair, feeling tired. He'd like nothing better than to take the day off, go for a nice long ride on his bike, to enjoy the cold, crisp morning while working up a little sweat. He grinned at himself. There was a pile of work on his desk that he couldn't get done if he worked 24-hour days for a month. Well, you knew the job was dangerous when you took it. Right? Right. Monday, January 3rd, 11:15 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. John Howard sat on Doc Kyle's couch in the base clinic, watching the older man flip through the hard copy printout.
"I don't know what to tell you, John. There's nothing growing in any dark corners that shouldn't be there."
"So why am I so tired all the time?"
Kyle grinned.
"Well, now, none of us is getting any younger. A man your age needs to realize he's not going to be able to run basic with the recruits forever."
"You're saying I should slow down?"
"Not should. You will slow down. That's the nature of the beast."
Howard stared at him. It wasn't as if the doc was giving him a death sentence.
"All right. Thanks, Doc.
Don't take it so hard, kid. You might have a couple more good years left. You want me to write you a prescription for some prunes and geritol?
Monday, January 3rd, 11:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone's life was over. He stood inside Cardio Sports, between the wrist heart monitor display and a display case of stopwatches, staring through the front window into the mall. From where he stood, he could easily see Bella, where she sat at one of the tables, where Belladonna Wright sat with Jefferson Benson, facing him across the little round white table, holding his hands with her hands, smiling at him. Oh, God. Tyrone was on afternoon shift at school, like she was, and so he'd asked her if she was going to the mall. They could meet, grab lunch, head for classes. No, she'd said. Not today. She had to run some errands, she'd said. So she wasn't going to the mall. She'd see him later at school. Fine, that was no pra. And yet, there she was, sitting there with Benson, holding his fucking hands, smiling at him. She'd lied to him. As he watched, Bella stood, and so did Benson. They moved around the table, closer to each other. Benson bent over. The worst thing he could imagine happened. Benson kissed her. No, there was something even worse than that. She kissed Benson back. Finally, they finished. Benson turned and went one way, Bella the other. What should he do? Should he go out and confront her? See what she said? Oh, man, he wanted to die. Right here, right now. Just go up in a blast of fire and smoke and be dead and gone. And not to know this. Not to have to think about it. Not to have to deal with it. What was he going to do? How could he live with this? At that moment, he couldn't see any way. No way at all. Monday, January 3rd, 12:10 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Julio Fernandez stood in the cold at the start of the obstacle course next to the chinning station. He spent 5 minutes warming up, rolling his shoulders and stretching his neck. If he didn't do that, he would probably strain his traps, and walking around with a sore neck for the next week didn't appeal to him, especially given his already gimpy status. He curled his hips up, pointed his legs. He could even feel that in his wounded leg, then chinned himself. One. He repeated the move, then did it again, getting into the rhythm. Two. Three. Four. Doing it in an L-sit made it harder, but that was the point. The idea was to make the muscles work. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. He let himself down, lowered his legs, released the bar. He was warmed up pretty good now. He caught the bar in an underhand pull-up grip. This time, spaced about shoulder width. That was the only difference between chins and pull-ups, whether your palms faced away or toward you. One. Two. Three. Four. The biceps started to burn first, but the forearms were right there, too. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. It was getting tough now. Nine. Come on, Julio. You can make it. 10. He dropped, hung on to the bar for a second, then let go.
I didn't think you were going to make that last one.
He turned. Joanna Winthrop. He grinned.
Me neither.
She wore running shoes and sweats, dark blue pants, and a matching hooded shirt with the NetForce logo on the front.
So, what brings you out here? Too much time at the desk. Every so often I have to get away and clear my head. How's the leg? You want the macho answer or the truth? Oh, both, please. Well, the macho answer is, no problem. And the truth? That sucker is sore.
They smiled at each other.
So you're going to do the course? That was the idea. How about I hobble along and watch? Yeah, I can live with that.
Monday, January 3rd, 12:15 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex was running a little late, and Tony was already dressed and warmed up, practicing Sempak and Deepak postures. She bowed him in and set him to practicing his juru. He only had the first one, but it was obvious he'd been practicing away from class. Another month or two and he'd be ready to start the second. After about 15 minutes, she called a stop. She walked to where her jacket was folded and pulled the kris in its sheath from under the cloth. He raised his eyebrows.
Is this Indonesian?
Yes, my guru presented it to me when I went home for Christmas.
She handed it to him.
The blade is made by welding and hammering various kinds of iron or steel together, then forging them into one piece. Many of the traditional kris are designed to be lucky, in war or love or business.
Which is this one?
She shrugged. I'm not sure. The magic apparently changes a little with each new owner.
Lucky in love, she hoped.
She took the kris, went back to her jacket, and rewrapped the weapon. Back in front of Alex, she said, Okay, let's work a little on applications from the juru. See, you are bigger and stronger than I am, and if you punch really hard, I might not be able to deflect it using pure muscle. But if I brace my block, thus, and my hips are corked properly, I have a mechanical advantage. Remember, this stuff was created with the idea that if you needed it, your attacker was going to be bigger, stronger, faster, probably armed, and there might be four or five of him.
He smiled. Got it.
You will, you will. Practice makes perfect. Now, punch.
He stepped in, threw a right, and braced with his left hand. She blocked it and demonstrated the counter.
Good, again. This was going well.
Maybe the kris was lucky in love. Wouldn't that be nice? Tuesday, January 11th, 9:50 a.m., Bombay, India. Jay Gridley walked into the small storefront tobacco shop to the jingle of a spring-mounted warning bell on the doorframe. The time was late 1890s, and the British Raj was still in full sway. Bombay was, of course, Indian, but the English flag draped heavily over the city, as it did the entire country. A month-old copy of the London Times lay upon the counter, next to a large glass jar full of cheap cigars, and a small wooden box of strike-anywhere matches and a metal tray of cedar lighting sticks. Not what he was looking for. Ah, there it was, the Delhi Ledger. He thumbed through the cheap newsprint and smudged the ink, getting it on his fingers. Well, at least that was a nice touch. The article was ostensibly about Danes come to visit India, but there in the fluffy travel piece was the name he wanted, the Freed Sexer. Once upon a time, Jay would have thought it was odd to find a bit of information about Denmark in an Indian infonet, but not anymore. Information was like dust. It blew around in the wind and wound up in places you'd never think it would. He took the paper to the front, paid for it, and went out into the Indian afternoon. Tuesday, January 11th, 10:15 a.m., Blacktown, New South Wales, Australia. Jay had switched from his tropical linens into an Abercrombie and Fitch khaki outfit, shorts and a short-sleeved shirt. His next stop was a small library in Blacktown, just north and west of Sydney.
Can I help you, sir?
Yes, ma'am, I'm looking for this periodical.
He put a slip of paper onto the woman's desk.
Oh, right, in the magazine section.
Thank you, ma'am.
Jay smiled. This was perhaps a little more time-consuming than a non-VR search, but if he couldn't have fun, why bother? Tuesday, January 11th, 10:40 a.m., Johannesburg, South Africa. In a police station in Boksburg, a man arrested for stealing a car had been searched. There had been nothing in the arrestee's wallet save a business card, upon the back of which was the handwritten word Friedsexer. Next to the word was an old-style internet provider ID number. Jay collected the card. He grinned. These Balrogs didn't have a prayer. Tuesday, January 11th, 10:50 a.m., Kobe, Japan. At a beef ranch in Kobe, somebody had broken in and stolen, of all things, a case of beer. Investigating policemen had no clues save one. Scrawled on the wall was the word Friedsexer. Jay made note of that. He was gathering his ducks. When he had enough of them, he would put them into a row. And then?
Well, we'll just see, won't we? I got your fried sex right here, pal.
Tuesday, January 11th, 11:15 a.m., Miami Beach, Florida. Platt strolled along one of the touristy streets near the canal, enjoying the 70-degree weather. Life was sure grand when you could just pick up and go to where you could walk around in a T-shirt and shorts in the middle of the winter. Platt grinned. He was just stalling so he wouldn't have to go back to work. He sighed. Might as well get to it. He didn't have any illusions about how good he was on the net. He was better than some, but not as sharp as the real experts.
In VR, some of the Net Force players would dance circles around him in a head-to-head match. Thing was, tricky and pretty sharp. Beat real sharp every time. And the Net Force pukes were fooling themselves, so that helped a bunch. The Net Force guys were looking for terrorists, because that's what they were most afraid of. So, zap, Platt and Hughes gave them some terrorists. This whole bullshit Danish thing was Hughes's idea, but it was pretty smart. Platt had started planting stuff about the fried socks thing 5 or 6 months ago, so some of the clues were absolute boilerplate when it came to real time. Some of the clues were yet to be put into place, but when they got there, they'd be backdated to seem as if they'd been there for months or years. By the time the Net Force pukes got to those, they wouldn't bother to check, or if they did, they'd do a half-assed job, since that's what they wanted to believe.
If it looks like a rabbit, smells like a rabbit, and hops like a rabbit, well, hell, it is a rabbit, ain't it?
When the hounds caught the quarry's scent, when they knew for sure they were on the right track, then he could let them see the rabbit. When it took off running, they'd follow it. They'd never catch it, because it wasn't real. It was a phantom, a spook, a ghost.
And boy, it was going to be fun to watch them chase that sucker.
But of course, the thing he had to do was make sure the hounds still wanted to chase the critter. So this afternoon, he was going to give him a new reason.
A real good reason this time.
Wednesday, January 12th, 6:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard pretty much wanted to die. He lay on his bed, staring through the ceiling, unable to move for the weight of what Bella had dropped on him. He had replayed the conversation 100 times in his head.
So, meet anybody interesting at the mall lately?
Give her credit, she wasn't stupid, and she didn't pretend she didn't know what he was talking about.
Maybe I did. What business is it of yours?
Wham, another punch to the gut.
Jesus, Bella, I thought we were... You and I mean, we were... What, married? Well, attenzione, Tyrione, we are not. I like you. You're sharp. But I have other friends, you copy? I see them when and where I want. You pra that?
And then she turned and left. His world went gray. He couldn't hear the students around him, couldn't see anything, couldn't feel anything, except a twist in his stomach.
Son, you okay?
Tyrone looked at the doorway. His father stood there.
Bella and I broke up.
His father came into the room.
Not your idea, I take it.
No, not my idea.
You want to talk about it?
No, not really.
But then, as they had with Bella, the words somehow just came tumbling out. John Howard listened to his son, felt his anguish and pain, but there was nothing he could say that was going to heal this wound. A broken heart accepted no medicine except time. That the first case of puppy love squashed would someday be nothing more than a small scar in the grand cosmic scheme of things was not what Tyrone wanted to hear. Still, it was all he had to offer. Howard sighed.
When I was 16, I was in love. A girl at my school, Lisbeth Toland, same class. We were tight, went everywhere together.
Tyrone stared at him.
It's kind of hard for you to imagine me with anybody except Mom, isn't it?
Tyrone nodded.
Then I got a call from my best friend, Rusty Stevens. He'd been at a bar one night and seen Lisbeth there with somebody he didn't know, partying pretty good.
That's terrible, Tyrone said.
The summer went on. Rusty called again. He'd seen Lisbeth out again, dancing, drinking, different guy, different place. He took it upon himself to follow them when they left.
They drove up to Lover's Point, parked in the guy's car, fogged up the windows in the middle of July. So I thanked Rusty and said I'd take care of it. On a Friday night late, I caught a cab to Lisbeth's house.
When I got there, I saw Rusty's beat-up old Chevrolet parked out front. Then I looked in and saw Rusty and Lisbeth wrapped around each other in the front seat, both of them half undressed.
What happened?
I stood there for what felt like a couple million years, watching them kiss and fondle each other. Didn't seem real, like it was a bad dream. I reached out and tapped on the driver's side window. They both jumped a couple feet. Then I left.
Jesus, Dad?
Yep. Lost my girl and my best friend at the same time. I could have punched Rusty's teeth in. But I figured people who do crap like this will get there someday. I didn't want to have anything else to do with them.
even to the point of not bloodying my knuckles on Rusty's lion face. There was silence. Finally, Tyrone said,
"So what happened to them, Rusty and Lizbeth?"
Howard grinned. "They got married right after graduation. He's now a medical doctor. She's an English professor. They have 3 kids, and according to my relatives back home who keep me up to date about such things, they have a wonderful marriage."
He got a small smile back from his son.
"You gonna eat supper?"
"I don't think so. I'm really not hungry."
"Okay. I'll cover it with Mom."
"Thanks, Dad. And, Dad, thanks for telling me this story."
"You're welcome, son."
Wednesday, January 12th, 7 p.m., Washington, D.C. The garage sure felt empty. Michael stood in the doorway, looking at the larger of his 2 big metal tool caddies. His most recent project car, the Plymouth Prowler, was gone, sold within a couple of days after he'd gotten it running right. He smiled and walked back into the house. Might as well see what he had for supper. In the kitchen, he dug around in the freezer and came up with a choice of garden burgers or teriyaki chicken sandwiches. He shrugged. The garden burger was going to get freezer burned if he didn't eat it pretty soon, but to hell with it. He wanted the chicken. As he reached for it, the phone rang.
"Hello."
Yeah, hello. I'm looking for Alex Michaels, the guy who does car stuff."
"You found him."
"Oh, hey. My name is Greg Skates. I got your name from Todd Jackson."
Todd Jackson was the man who had bought the Prowler.
"I've got a car Todd thinks you might be interested in."
"What kind of car?"
"It's a Mazda MX-5, a 1995.
Michael's eyebrows went up. MX-5 was better known in the U.S. as the Miata, a little drop-top two-seater, a lot smaller than the Prowler.
"I have to be honest with you, Mr. Michaels. I don't know a lot about it. It belonged to my father, who passed away in November."
"What kind of shape is it in?"
"I can't really say. Dad pulled the tires off and put it up on jacks in his garage. As far as I know, it's been sitting like that for about 15 years.
Michaels felt a surge of interest. You heard about these things. Low or no mileage cars stored in somebody's barn for future sale.
"So what do you figure the car is worth, Mr. Skates?"
"Greg, please. I don't know, but Todd says if you're interested, you'll offer me a fair price."
"I'm interested, Greg, but I'm not going to be able to see the car until Saturday. Can you sit on it that long?"
"No problem."
Michaels nodded at the unseen speaker.
"Good."
He got directions and a time, then hung up. Time for the teriyaki. Thursday, January 13th, 9 a.m. Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes rode in a bulletproof Cadillac limo from his hotel toward the new presidential palace, and the ride was not particularly impressive. Even though the former president, João Bernardo Vieira, and his African Party for the Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde had dragged the locals kicking and screaming into the modern era, it was still a third-world country. There were no railroads, only a couple of 1,000 miles of badly paved roads, 1 airport big enough for international flights to land at, and it was cheaper to use local pesos for toilet paper than it was to buy toilet paper. At least it was the dry season. During the monsoons, you didn't walk, you waited. Hughes was on his way to meet President Fernandez Domingos, a not particularly bright man who had somehow lucked into the job. If things went as planned, Hughes would make Domingos richer than he had ever dreamed of being, and able to indulge his tastes in more pleasant circumstances than the dirty streets of Guinea.
"The compound is just ahead, sir,"
the driver said. He was large, white, and had a clipped post-English accent. On the seat next to him lay a submachine gun, and Hughes knew that under his chauffeur's coat the driver also carried a large-caliber pistol. The limo arrived in front of a big electrically-operated metal gate in a pink stone wall. A pair of guards with assault rifles outside the gate drifted over and bent to look inside the limo. The Brit nodded at them, and it was obvious they knew him, but he offered his ID anyway. The driveway was circuitous and wound around several sharp-angled turns bounded by ponds or dirt mounds covered with grass. Eventually, the limo arrived at the entrance to the main building. Standing in front of a set of tall, carved wooden doors was President Fernandez Domingos. Hughes alighted from the limo as the driver held the door.
"Ah, Thomas, how good to see you again."
"Mr. President, I am honored.
Domingos waved that away.
No, no, none of that. We are friends. Please, come into my humble home. And I would like you to meet Miss Monique Lewis, who has just recently returned from Paris.
Hughes eyed the blonde, who smiled lazily at him, a hint of come-hither in her expression.
Bonjour, she said. So nice to make your acquaintance.
Unless he was terribly mistaken, the good president had apparently provided him with a companion. This, Hughes decided, should be interesting. Friday, January 14th, 6 a.m., New York City, New York. At Max, one of the last old-style hardcore gyms in Manhattan, Platt grunted through a set of heavy squats. He was in the safety rack, so the weight wasn't going to fall and crush his ass, but that didn't help his thighs. They burned like he was standing hip-deep in molten lava. Up he came, vibrating, shaking, quivering, fire flowing through his veins and arteries, burning his muscles hot right to the bone. Man! Three more! And he was able, barely, finally, to rack the weight. Around him, the clang of steel echoed as men grunted and strained against the big plates. There were a couple of women here, bodybuilders on the juice, so they looked like men. He liked to see a woman in shape, but not a male shape caused by mojo steroids that did everything but grow a dick on her. Well, enough of this. Time to shower and head for the place in Queens where he had his throwaway computer set up. Friday, January 14th, 8 a.m. Ambarsik, Siberia. Jay Gridley leaned into the fierce wind coming off the East Siberian Sea, a wind so strong and cold that it would blast an unprotected man to death in a matter of seconds. It was an unlikely place to be hunting for clues to a Danish terrorist organization, but there was a blowhole in the ice up ahead where seals came up to breathe, and one of those seals was the packet of information he wanted to find. A klaxon began screaming at him, loud and insistent. What the hell was that? Jay did the mental shift and realized that the klaxon was his real-time override, back at his workstation. A fire in the building, a major system failure. The pizza delivery truck had a flat. Better check this out quick. Jay logged himself out of VR.